to think about issues. Our brother John was asking why we're here, and I'll just tell you why I'm here. I'm here to discharge a debt that I owe you. I'm 63 years old, and I don't think most of you are that age. And so I owe you a debt. Older people owe younger people a debt, and I'm going to try to pay some of that debt over this weekend. I'm not really here to entertain you. I do have the responsibility to engage your heart and your mind. That's part of my job. And my job is also to keep you engaged. And I'm hoping that the material I shared with you is so, I don't know what word to use, full of drama, that you know, all you have to do is just open your eyes and ears, that's all. Every session will be followed by a question and answer period. So if you're engaged, don't hesitate. I notice the back of your program is empty. There's a good place to put your questions. And the only dumb question is the one that's not asked. When I was a little boy in school, I was always afraid to ask questions because everybody would think how ignorant I was. I exposed my ignorance. I was the dummy. I remember Kate Rosenberry in my class. She'd ask all kinds of questions. Well, she was a smart girl. She got answers to her questions. I was afraid to ask. I was the loser. I would like to begin this evening by reminding us that God is a storyteller. When He starts out with His Word, He starts out with a story. The creation story. After the creation story is the story of the fall of man. And that's followed by the story of Cain and Abel. And we go on through Genesis and we have the story of Noah and the flood. And then we have the story of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah. And we go on down through their stories and we end up in the book of Genesis with the story of Joseph. And then we go into Exodus, which is the story of the Israelites coming out of Egypt into the Promised Land. We have the story of their wanderings for 40 years in the desert. And then we have the story of them going into the land. And we have the story eventually of the kings in the land. Saul. And the story of David. And the story of Solomon. And all those other kings. And it's all written there. And we notice how poorly some of them did in their story. In their personal stories. And we shake our heads and we say, why didn't they have their heads screwed on straight? And then we come to the end of the Old Testament where God says, okay, if you all want to do it that way, I don't have to be here. And so God shuts His mouth for 400 years. And after 400 years, He just comes and breaks right into history with another story. He sends His own Son into the world. And that's the story of the Incarnation and the story of Jesus' ministry. And then we have the story of the crucifixion and the story of the resurrection. And then we have the story of how the church developed in the book of Acts. And then the book of Acts ends. And we are followed by epistles. And we have the book of Revelation, which is kind of like, you could say, a future story. Story beginning in the Bible. The Bible ends with a story. Now I have a question for you. If God is that interested in story, do you think He expects us maybe to pay attention to some stories for the last 2,000 years? Or are we only supposed to pay attention to these stories? Well, open your Bibles with me to Psalm 78. I think we can answer this question here. I think I'll start reading in verse 2. Of Psalm 78. He says, I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known. And our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from their children. Telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and His strength and His wonderful works that He has done. For He established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Let me share something with you on an overhead. It's a sad truth, but that's what these verses are saying. Anyone who contemplates history cannot help but notice how the gift of blessed forgetfulness is given to virtually every generation in the unrolling years of history. This gift makes it possible for a given age, in the midst of its blithe optimism, to repeat the fatal mistakes of a previous generation with hardly a pang of remorse or fear. And the heart of God is throbbing in Psalm 78, saying, please, please, please don't do it again. I've told you, please pay attention. Flip over to Joshua 4. This is a practical one now. How the stories are to be done. Just breaking into part of the story, if you go to verse 4 of Joshua 4. It says, Joshua called the 12 men whom he appointed from the children of Israel, one man from every tribe. And Joshua said to them, cross over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of Jordan. And each one of you take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel. Excuse me. That this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord when it crossed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off. And these stones, excuse me, and these stones shall be for a memorial to the children of Israel forever. Now go down to verse 19. Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of Jordan, Joshua set up in Gilgal. Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, tell the story. Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which He dried up before us until we had crossed over, that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Lord, that it's mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Once again, illustrating the way God plans that this whole thing gets transmitted from generation to generation is usually by story. And we have not done so well. My guess is that you have not heard most of what I'm going to say tonight. You might have known bits and pieces about it. Let me, before I get too far into this, how many of you here have a Russian Mennonite or Dutch Mennonite background? Okay. Hands high. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, well, I'm going to be talking about your people. I'm really delighted that some of you are here. May I know what your last name is? Wadel. Okay. Okay, what is your mother's maiden name? Ginter. Okay, and what's your last name? Okay, does your mother have a what's your mother's maiden name? Okay, and what about you? And what's your mother's maiden name? Okay, and I saw another hand back there. Okay, well, I'm not recognizing those last names as Russian Mennonite names. I am recognizing this lady's mother. So I'm not sure about all that. We can talk about that later. So I think for all of us here, for most of us here, we're going to be talking about the cousins. This is the story of the cousins. This is not your background. Only this lady's background. And so that's why it's not as familiar to us. The job of a teacher is to work himself out of a job. Now, I flew all the way out of here from Indiana, and I only brought a few books with me, but I cannot tell you this weekend or everything that you should know. And I'm hoping that I can introduce a few books to you so that you can pursue this on your own. I haven't looked at your school library. Do you have the Smith's History of the Mennonites? Smith's Story of the Mennonites in your library? Do you have that? Okay, you don't have that. Okay. Do you have Introduction to Mennonite History by Dick? Okay. Now, both of those books give our story and the Russian story. Both. They're overviews. Through Fire and Water. Do you have that book? You got that one. Okay, got one of them. Okay, so all I'm going to give you is a little overview as well. So I'm hoping, just hoping, that I pique your interest so that you get the books out and you read more of the story for yourself. All right, now I'm going to I am a teacher, so I'm going to be a teacher right up front here. Since this is not our story, I need to tell you and locate this. This is not a dream story I'm going to tell you. This is not just a fictionalized account that somebody thought up. This is real, true stuff that I'm going to be telling you. So first of all, we have to locate it. This is a map of Europe. This is Spain. This is Portugal. This is France. This is Ireland. This is England. Where we're going to be focusing here is on the Netherlands, right there. Okay, now we're going to zoom in a little bit further. No, sorry, before we zoom in, let's look at this. Almost every one of us sitting right here started out from Switzerland. Now, the story of the Swiss, you'll notice, goes several directions, including the Hutterites grow out of who we are. But that's not where we're going tonight. What we are, our descendants of the people came to Pennsylvania beginning in around 1710. Every single one of us, except this lady. And she's half this, so it's her part of her story too. Okay, this movement began in Switzerland in 1525. Well, there was a man who took it north to Holland and northern Germany by the name of Melchior Hoffman. And when he was preaching up in Holland, Anabaptism took root up there, and it became a second origin, place of origin. Okay, here's us. And the story I'm going to tell you is here. A very few of them came to America at the very beginning, but they didn't come for religious reasons, I don't think. They came for business reasons. But the bulk of them, in the midst of persecution, moved east to get away from persecution. They moved first to Prussia. Well, they moved, they just kept moving east. But a large group of them finally moved to Prussia. And at one time, this was the largest concentration of Mennonites in the whole wide world. There were 10,000 or more stacked together right here in the Vistula Delta. Well, then eventually, in our story here, a bunch of them moved down here to Ukraine, where Kortitsa and Malashna. And that's where so many things happened. And eventually, after this, then they all came to America or else died there. It's just an awful, awful, awful story. Now, zooming in even further. The persecution in some of these areas under Charles V was so intense that it actually wiped out Anabaptism here in Flanders. They all got chased out. And the way they went then to escape persecution, it goes north. The people from Flanders are called Flemish. The people up in here were called Friesians. And these people had different cultures. And part of our story is the story of how two cultures couldn't mesh. I don't want to get ahead of myself. Okay, just for some points of interest here. See this place right here? This is Dordrecht. You've all heard of the Dordrecht Confession. Okay? My son and my father and I were in Holland driving around one day, and I wanted to go see this place. It's so important to history. So I drove down the road, and sure enough, the sign, just a big overhead sign, says, Dordrecht, this way. So I went to Dordrecht. Once I got to Dordrecht, where do I find the place that had this confession? I had no idea. So I went and found a policeman, and I said, where can I find the Mennonite church? Mennonite? What is that? I had to try to explain a little bit. He says, oh, Dorpsgezinde. Just a minute, please. So he got on the phone, talked to somebody in Dutch, Holland Dutch now. And after a while, he came back to me. He says, okay, follow me. So he got in his police car, and I was trailing behind him. And we ended up at the Dordrecht Mennonite Church. But it was a new building. It certainly wasn't the old building. But at least I could say I was there where it happened. That, for me, that's real special, to be there where it happened. Okay, that's Dordrecht. Okay, now, I want you to notice. Oh, while we're at it here, I wasn't planning to say this, but here's The Hague. You know, the world court takes place right there. Most of your people, or many of your people, came to this country. They launched off from Rotterdam. Let's see, where do I see? Right here is Rotterdam. They got on a boat to come to this country. Okay, more of my focus is north. Okay, right there. You see Pingjum, Witmarsum, right there. Pingjum is where Menno Simons was preaching and under conviction at the same time. And so my son and my father and I, we wanted to go visit Pingjum. So this was on Ascension Day in Europe. And I didn't know it, but all Europe closes down on Ascension Day. It's a holiday. And so we drove up to this church house, and lo and behold, they're having church in there. Wow. So we didn't really know what to do, so we knocked on the door and cracked it a little bit. We could see people inside, and somebody inside went like this. We weren't quite sure what to do. We just break into a service. Well, we took courage, opened up the door again, and we went in and sat down. And there was a man up preaching in the very same spot where Menno Simons used to preach. Wow. I thought about using my camera and take a picture of him, but I didn't. It was all in Holland Dutch. I couldn't understand a thing. Well, after the service is over, these people came to us and they said, why are you here? I said, well, Menno Simons used to preach in this church. Yeah, we know that. Yeah. I said, I wanted to come here. And I said to the minister, who had taken off all his robes by that time, I said, I was thinking about taking a picture of you while you're preaching. He says, oh, thank you very much for not doing that. Whew, man, I didn't. He says, I will put my robes on again, and I'll go back up there, and you may take a picture of me up there again. So that's what he did. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Now, Menno also, after he got converted and he left the Pingjum Church, he went over here to Witmarsum. That's where his field of work was. And by the way, this church is no longer Mennonite or Dorpsgezinde. It's Reformed. It's Calvinistic. It's Presbyterian today. Now, let me tell you what we're talking about by this Dorpsgezinde. The people, the Anabaptists in the Netherlands right here, they were called Anabaptists, I guess, for a while, but that was the name given by the enemy. And they didn't like this word Mennonite either, named after a man, so they preferred Dorpsgezinde, which means baptism-minded. And that's how they're known today. And I'll have more to say about that. Okay, Do you realize that every one of those dots that you see was a Mennonite church? Looks like there's quite a few of them, doesn't there? Lots of them. This is the Zuider Zee. This is the place where they're reclaiming land from the sea. And Mennonites were very much a part of that. If there's ever a Russian Mennonite icon, it's a windmill. Because they used windmills to run the pumps to pull the water out of these polder lands. And I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of acres have been reclaimed from the Zuider Zee. And you can drive across right here. This is a big causeway with big sluice gates where they still have to control the sea. And the windmills that they have off the coast right here today are these big, giant windmills that have these huge arms that circle. And windmills are still a part of Holland to this very day. Not the old kind, though. Okay. But as I said, as they began to be persecuted, the only way to deal with that is to go this way. Before I forget about it. When you drive around the countryside here, you see a kind of architecture that the Russian Mennonites kept with them when they went to Russia. Before I get there, this is Menno Simon's house in northern Germany. Whenever he had to go east, that was his place. Now, this is kind of an antiquated picture, but they have house barns. The house and the barn are all one building. And they're still that way today. You go over there, and you can tell where the house is because it has a metal roof, and the barn because it has a thatch roof. And the reason they did is so the animal heat could be a part of what kept the people warm. You could say, well, how can that be? That would be awfully smelly. Well, you go in those, there's very much of a division between the house and the barn. You can't tell you're in a barn. One of the things that just fascinates me is that they have this thatch on their barns that's about, I don't know, 6 inches thick today. And if there's any barn with a thatch that's still there, it's one the Nazis didn't burn. Because the Nazis went through this neighborhood with their flamethrowers, and you can imagine how easy it was to catch thatch and burn it. You know, just go down the road and just burn this barn or this barn all over. Okay, but the whole concept of house barns, the Russian Mennonites took to Russia. Here's another one. This was in Poland. This is the front part. This is where the people lived. And the back is the barn part. All right, back to where we were. Here are some more places going further east. This is Denmark up here. This is what you call North Germany. And every one of these places is where there's a Mennonite church. This particular place, right? See Westenfeld right there? Right there. Yeah, right there. That's where Menno Simons is buried. That's where he ended his life. Okay, now, I want you to pay attention here on this one. See, here is Flanders. And here's Brussels, where those recent terrorist attacks took place. Here's Rotterdam. Here's Amsterdam. Here's where they have all those polders. Here's Pingjum. Here's Witmarsum. Okay, down here is where we come from. My Weaver family comes from Zurich. If you have an Amish background or Amish Mennonite background, which I think most of you have out here, your people came from Bern. And your people only came into the Anabaptist movement 150 years after it started. That's a whole story in itself. Do any of you here have the book Unserlite by Leroy Beachy? Well, you all need that book. It's two books, really. It's 1,000 pages. Very well done. The author drew his own pictures. But every one of your last names, your stories are in there. Your family stories are in there. If you want to get a gift for your parents, get them Unserlite. Unserlite translates into our people. Okay. And you'll notice that this is the Rhine River. And you'll notice also that when the Switzerland finally, after trying years and years to get us out, finally got us moved up in here to this area, the Palatinate. That's our story. I'm not going to tell you that story. But we finally, when William Penn came here and started preaching among us and offering us the chance to go to Pennsylvania, we left. And we went over, some of our people went to America, and then they wrote letters back, and America fever started. And this place just emptied out. Because they wanted to go to America. That's not where I'm going. These people did not have that kind of a story. They just heard that you have more freedom if you go east, especially when you got the Vistula Delta in Poland. And the reason that was so interesting and attractive is that the Vistula Delta is a very low area, and they needed people who knew how to empty that, to create polder land, to create farmland from this swamp. And so that's why so many people went there. Okay. I'm just going to go until I run out of time tonight. There's more to this story than I'll ever get told, but I'll try. I'll try to get started. When you were little boys and girls, when you were at school, you studied the Spanish Armada. Someone tell me what that's all about. How many of you ever heard of the Spanish Armada? Okay, you've heard it, but you all forgot it. Okay. Well, Charles V, he was a very zealous Catholic. And the people in England, let me just get you oriented here once again. The people in England over here were naughty. Over here, I'm sorry. The Netherlands and France were all Catholic. And so he got this armada down here in Spain someplace. I don't know where he started from. I forget that part of it. But he took, I think it was 188 ships, some of the best fitted ships possible. Because he was going up here and he was going to teach these English people a lesson. He was going to defend the Holy Mother Faith. Well, when he did that, you remember the story. They got into a fight right here in this channel, this English channel, and the English boats were smaller. And they went in around these Spanish ships and set them on fire. And to escape, many of these ships went out this side, out the east side of the English channel, and tried to go home by going up around Scotland. Well, up there they ran into storms, which destroyed a bunch more boats. And so of the 188 that started out, only half of them ever came back. And Philip II said, I sent these boats out to fight men. I didn't send them out to fight wind. Okay, it seemed as if God was against him. And he just could not understand how in the world God could be against the Holy Mother Faith. Okay, he was Catholic. This is in 1688. This is long after Anabaptism had first started. Okay, it's this kind of zealousness that helps us understand why Anabaptism was so persecuted in this area. Okay, believe it or not, it became one of the first places to end persecution. The persecution that our people suffered lasted much longer in Switzerland. Freedom came early for these people. Okay, but in the meantime, while they were being persecuted, it's doubtful whether any other people in Europe suffered the ravages of religious intolerance and political oppression as did the inhabitants of the lowlands under Charles V and his son, Philip II. No other group in Europe can claim as many martyrs as the Mennonites. Between 1531 and 1600, more Mennonites were put to death for the sake of their religious convictions in the Netherlands alone than from all the religious groups in England during the same period. When my son and my father were in this area, we decided, it does not show it on here, but it's about right in here. There's a castle at Ghent. How many of you read the book In the Belly of a Whale, or In the Whale's Belly? It's a children's book. Okay, well, that book focuses on what happens at this castle in Ghent. At this castle alone, over 110 Anabaptists were killed. And when you go into that place, you can actually see today yet the instruments of torture that were there. And I learned some things. I'm going to take a little time to tell you how some of this worked. I mean, you know about some of the things, but I did not know about this device. It's a ring it's about this big around. It fits over a person's neck. And all around the ring are points, like spikes that stick out. And so they put it around and they clamp it, and you can't move because as soon as you start moving, these spikes jag you. Okay, so they put you on a chair in the center of a room, and they put this neck device on, and then they have wires that run from this collar that go to the four corners of the room so that you can't move this thing at all. Okay, after you're sitting on this chair with this collar fastened around you, then they light a fire under the chair. And they said, right there, nobody could stand that torture for more than 2 or 3 hours. They just go crazy. And there's other instruments of torture there. The beheading swords. Do you ever see a beheading sword? I mean, those things are big. The blade itself is about this long, plus the handle. And you know that being an executioner was not the nicest job. And so sometimes the executioner had to get drunk in order to do this. Now, can you imagine taking a big sword like this if you're drunk? If you do it right, the head goes off the first shot. But what happens if you are so drunk that you only hit the shoulders? Or you hit the skull? Then you got to do it again. Pretty messy stuff. It's all there. If you ever go to this part of the world, don't miss going to the castle at Ghent. You will not come out the same. Philip II, one of these Catholic rulers, issued an edict in 1556 forbidding all laymen to discuss or teach the Holy Scriptures on penalty of death. Men were to be executed with the sword, women buried alive. Persistence in their errors meant burning in fire. Always their property was confiscated. Anabaptism was to be ruthlessly destroyed. Now this, at the beginning, was not a religious thing. It was a criminal. It was criminal to become an Anabaptist because these people understood that society, just like fabric, has a warp and a woof. You have to have church and you have to have state. And you can't take the church away from the state or the fabric will fall apart. This is the way society was for 1,000 years. And if Anabaptism came and says, we obey God, we don't have to have a state church, we just obey God. You were a criminal who was threatening anarchy in the state, and they may not allow those kind of people to be around. They need to be destroyed. That is why Anabaptism had such ferocious treatment at the beginning. They didn't want their society to fall apart. Now, it's very, very interesting. I'm really, really pleased to be able to tell you this. I wish all of you knew this, but I've learned by sad experience that if I'd asked the question, almost none of you would know this, and I'm going to tell you. This is one of the debts that I need to discharge to you. Do you know that Anabaptism, in its beginnings in Switzerland and in the Netherlands here, and the sufferings that they endured actually changed the course of Western history. They were the only people who were brave enough to pay the price of blood for the idea of separation of church and state. Everything else was church and state. And it was so ingrained in people that when the Puritans started coming over here in Plymouth Rock, 1620 for Pilgrim, 1607 in Virginia. In the 1600s, the Puritans and the Pilgrims built a state church in New England and were willing to persecute Quakers. Or if our people had been there, we would have been tolerated either. We would have been persecuted in New England. So the state church idea was translated from Europe to New England. In Virginia, which was Anglican, Puritan and Anglican are the same church, the one's just a different version of it, but they both have state church. In Virginia, it wasn't quite that intense, but it was still state church. And then, of all things, William Penn did the unthinkable thing. He got this gift of land from the King of England, and he decided he's going to try a holy experiment. And so in 1683, he started this Pennsylvania idea where there was no such thing as a state church. Nobody had to belong to a state church. People could be free. And by the way, he invited the persecuted Mennonites or Anabaptist Swiss brethren to come to Pennsylvania. And they did. And Quakers came. They were persecuted over there. They came. And the Moravians came. And the Church of the Brethren, Alexander Mack, his entire group came. And Count Zinzendorf, somebody said, in Pennsylvania, all these religious groups were like fish moving past each other in the water. And nobody makes any issues with anybody else. Defying all history, the Pennsylvania model worked. They couldn't believe it. And when it came time to write the U.S. Constitution, they wrote the Pennsylvania model into the U.S. Constitution. And today, with the First Amendment, we have freedom of religion, freedom of press, freedom of assembly. That is the gift of the Anabaptist movement to the modern world. Now, I don't believe in being proud at all, but you can be very, very pleased to have that as your background. The model of freedom comes from your forefathers who are willing to pay the price of their blood for it. And now, the United States believes in it so much, they're trying to take this model of freedom and put it over into Muslim countries, and there's no philosophical foundation. Sharia law is built on a state church model. You cannot have freedom, according to the Quran, if you're going to be strict with it. Okay, instead of Anabaptism being completely destroyed, like it was in Flanders, they began to move, like I said, first north and then to further east. So, Flanders was emptied of Anabaptists by 1600. There was a continual stream to England, East Friesland, Poland, West Prussia along the Vistula River. And the last North Dutch Mennonite martyr, according to Martyr's Mirror, was executed at Leeuwarden in 1574. That's not very long after it started. That's less than 50 years. The last martyr in Holland. In the south, a woman was buried alive in Brussels in 1597. Perhaps half of the 1,500 martyrs mentioned in Martyr's Mirror were from this area. And those people accounted for about 3/4 of all the Protestant martyrs of that time. If you look at Martyr's Mirror, our story began to unfold. And so there's maybe about 20 or 30 pages at the end of Martyr's Mirror, just about this thick. Martyr's Mirror is not really our book. Our story is at the very end. The Martyr's Mirror is these people's book. But the interesting thing is, these people have rejected it today, basically. And our people have picked it up and valued it. And there's a whole story about the martyr's mirror. That's not my subject. Okay, now, in order to understand all this, you need to come Sunday morning, because we're going to talk about why this area became the land of division. Did you know men of Simon's believe false doctrine? He had two errors. One of them was the celestial flesh error, where he did not believe that Jesus Christ partook of the nature of Mary. He believed that that Mary was just like a tube from God to earth for Mary. He couldn't understand how Jesus could be born of Mary without partaking of her nature and still be sinless. And so, he insisted that Jesus did not partake of the nature of Mary. And that's called docetism. It's an error. And his enemies in his day like to taunt him with that error. But the poor man, he was doing the best he knew. Modern science, if he had modern science, he wouldn't have believed that. But that's the way it was. And that ideas always have consequences. We're going to talk more about that on Sunday morning. And so, this area, with this kind of a concept of the celestial flesh, became the land of division. The Flemish people from the south down here were less rigid on this whole issue of the ban. And the leaders had less arbitrary control over the church. They wore finer clothes. But their friends up north, the Frisians, had more of this kind of a concept. The leaders were more in control up here. They wore plainer clothes. They lived in plainer houses. This is where Menno Simons was from. This is where Dirk Phillips was from. And believe it or not, in this story, there are people from further south who came to visit Menno toward the end of his life and said, "Menno, would you just moderate? Please moderate some of your views." And Menno says, "Nope, I will not." And considered the people from the south as no longer his brethren. That's how rigid this whole thing was. But there's a reason for its rigidity. It has to do with the doctrine that Menno held. And we'll talk more about that on Sunday. And so these people, the Flemish and the Frisians, lived among each other, but they were separate from each other for almost 200 years. They excommunicated members who intermarried with each other and rebaptized members who switched from one side to the other. That's how strongly they felt about this. But there were a group of people over in here. They're called the Waterlanders, who early on got some ideas, say, "Look, this is silly that we're doing this kind of stuff." And they stopped doing it. They disagreed with Menno's view on celestial flesh. And they disagreed with the strict banning and the strict shunning, including marital shunning. But they did hold other basic Anabaptist doctrine. But they soon began to drift to marrying outside the church, participating in government, associating with non-Mennonite businessmen, having salaried ministers, and audible prayer. And they fully participated, eventually, in the golden age of Holland. Now, all of you have heard of Rembrandt. Now, that's not a very good picture. You can't see. If you want to see a better picture, you go home and get your Rembrandts out and study this picture. The title of this picture by Rembrandt, Mennonite Minister. Mennonite Minister of Anslow and his... No, that's his all told. He's known as the man with a golden voice. And if you would see this picture up close, you could say you could almost feel the golden voice that this man had. Some people think this is his wife. Other people think this is one of his parishioners. But he's talking to her. And it's a prize. It's an excellent example of Rembrandt. Here's another one of Rembrandt's pictures. This guy is a Mennonite. Mennonites were all over the place in those days. They became, whenever persecution ended, they became the premier in business. They became the merchants, and they became whalers, having whaling ships. And they eventually then participated in art. and there were Mennonite painters, just like Rembrandt. None of them became as famous as Rembrandt, but they did that. They saw that was their way forward. They were so repressed for a while, but whenever the government started letting up, they just entered into the opportunities. Do you know? And this, I just marvel at this. Do you know that one of the hardest things to accomplish is to maintain the faith in the context of freedom? Do you know that freedom has done for us, or to us as a people, what persecution never did? We have lost so much more to the faith from prosperity and freedom than we ever did through torture and death. Two of my children had lived and worked in California with a persecuted church that came out of Russia. And, you know, I know firsthand what I'm talking about here. Those people who came from Russia, from persecution, over here. The United States helped them get over here. Once they got into freedom, just lost their faith. And they had those schools. Some of the parents were saying, oh, why do we have to lose our children? It's an effort to keep their children. It's a whole story. That's not my topic here. But how in the world, and why are you sitting here tonight? Your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents have experienced freedom for all these years, and yet you're still here. How in the world did that happen? And again, that's a subject all of its own. And I say I have the highest respect for anybody who is able to pass the faith on in the context of freedom over generations. Because the greatest possibility of loss is in the context of freedom and prosperity. And so it's going to be coming your opportunity as young people as to whether you're going to lose your faith or whether you're going to see how valuable it is, treasure it, and pass it on within the context of freedom. And then you'll have your chance to live your story. We're looking at the stories of the past. Quakerism, George Fox, was likely influenced by Anabaptist teaching. Quakerism developed quite a few years after Anabaptism started. And non-resistance was one of those teachings. And I've already talked about William Penn repeatedly visiting the Dutch Mennonites to make proselytes. And do you know that some of the very first Mennonites who came to America were the Dutch, not our kind? I said they came for business, but now I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah, they came to New York earlier. But whenever Penn opened up Pennsylvania, the first ones came. I don't think those came for business. But almost all of them, and when they came over, were Mennonites, but converted to Quakers after they were here. And if you've ever read or gotten around Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, I know you're on the West Coast, you don't drive around places like that, but there is a German town right north of Pennsylvania. It figures heavily in the Revolutionary War. Well, that's where the Mennonites were. Germantown. There's a Germantown Mennonite church that's still in existence to this day. You can go look at it. The Baptist denomination traces its beginnings to the Dutch Mennonites. They claim Menno Simons is one of the heroes of their church. What's not quite fair in their history, they also jump over 100 years of history and go back to Balthasar Hubmaier, who was an Anabaptist theologian, but who died for his faith, I think, in 1527. But Balthasar Hubmaier did not believe in non-resistance. He believed that Christians ought to participate in government and they ought to carry the sword. And do you know there was almost an Anabaptist state at one time? He convinced the Lords von Liechtenstein to be this. And they were Anabaptist government leaders. And it was out of that context. They were called the Schwertler. They were the sword-bearer Anabaptist. Contrasted with the Stabler, which were the staff-bearers. I mean, back in those days, everybody had to do something. You either carried a sword with you, or you just carried a stick. And the Stablers were the people who just carried the stick. But the Schwertlers were many more. I don't know. They were the majority. Okay, that whole group of the Schwertler didn't last very long. It just disappeared. They could not reproduce themselves. It's the Stabler out of which the Hutterite was born. And they are still with us to this day. That's a very interesting consideration. If you want a fascinating study sometime, study the Hutterite story. That's not where we're going today. That's another story completely. English Congregationalists also acknowledge a heavy spiritual debt to the Dutch Mennonites. But the Dutch Mennonites began to decline both spiritually and numerically around 1700. And this decline is one of the major reasons why the Martyr's Mirror was put together by a young man by the name of Tielman van Brought. He was 32. He was ordained. And he noted that the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of the martyrs were just losing their faith. And he thought, well, you know, maybe we put some of these stories together, the martyr stories, maybe it'll help them understand how valuable their faith is. So we put the Martyr's Mirror together. It actually grew by several sections. There was the sacrifice of the martyrs was first, and they just kept adding to the Martyr's Mirror and adding to, and finally 1660 was the end. 1685 was the last edition of Martyr's Mirror, and that's when they put those etchings in, the pictures. And then it's done. It's an irony of history. The persecution by our people was still going on. And I, like I said, we got a few pages in the back of Martyr's Mirror of our story. But then the Anabaptists stopped collecting stories of costly discipleship. Until just a few years ago. And I didn't bring a single one along. I'm repenting of it right now. If you all want some, I'd be glad to help you with them. I couldn't carry very many on the airplane anyway, but I showed you a copy. The Bearing Witness Project is now started. It has produced its first book called Bearing Witness of Stories of Costly Discipleship once again. Now, we have individual story books that are published by CLP or Rod and staff. But there's been no collection of costly discipleship with the intention, like Tielman Brought, J. Van Brought had for the Martyr's Mirror until just recently. And I'm hoping that Bearing Witness is only this thick. It's published by Plow Publishing. I'm hoping that's just the beginning of more. Because folks, I got to tell you, I know you don't like to hear this, but you got tough times ahead. There are dark clouds in the horizons. Your elders, your parents and grandparents have handed you a very sad world, a broken world. Financially and morally, our country is literally falling apart before our eyes. And that's the world you're going into. What are you going to do? I'm afraid there's big time suffering ahead. And that's one of the reasons why there's Bearing Witness. We realize that the best defense against suffering is to realize that you're only a part of many other people who already suffered before you. So folks, don't get discouraged when suffering comes. Just understand that the context that we've lived in for the last 50 years of freedom is very unusual in history. But we've come to accept it as norm and to expect it. It just is this way. No, it's not. The cost of Christianity has always been high. And if we go back into suffering again, we're going back to normalcy. Now, here's the sad fact. This is true. In 1700, there were 160,000 members, Mennonites, in Netherlands. One-tenth of all Netherlands was Mennonite in 1700. By 1820, there's only 30,000 left. They lost 100 congregations in 100 years. Why? Here's why. This is not all of why, but this is part of why. The Dutch Mennonites grew very rapidly, but declined in numbers and spiritually just as rapidly. First of all, number one, worldliness. The prosperity and affluence of these diligent people inclined them to upward social mobility. Thus, it became easy to want to be like the world. And I've already talked to you a little bit about that with the Rembrandt pictures. Let me pause here to say, in your communities right here, I suppose, are you sending any kind of teachers down among the Old Colony Mennonites in Mexico from your churches? Oh, there's an awesome opportunity. That's not my story, but I'll just say this much. Do you know that wherever Dutch, Russian Mennonites go, things just prosper? You go down to Mexico. When you think of Mexico, you think of desert, and rightly so. But you could drive around in the desert, and suddenly, out of the desert, you'll find prosperity. Farms. Big grain bins. Fine John Deere equipment. The latest of this. Fine houses. Because the Mennonites learned how to drill wells down there, pump water up, and to create farms that are very excellent in production in the desert. The bad news is, they've been doing this for so long, the water table is dropping, and some of their wells are going dry. I don't know what they're going to do. But it's not just one place. It's several places. And these people have gotten reputations like they can make stuff grow out of a rock. Every place they go, things just prosper. That's one of the reasons why they wanted to come over the Vistula Delta in Prussia. Because they wanted the abilities of these people to make a swamp prosper. And that's exactly what happened. Catherine the Great was from Prussia. She saw what these Mennonites did over in Prussia. And she just won a war over in Ukraine. She says, I have all this empty land. I want it to bloom. I want it to prosper. And she thought about what she saw in Prussia. She says, I know where to get the people. So she made this offer to them, and I'll talk about that later if we ever get there, and said, I will offer you this, 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 and this if you come. And so they said, yes, we will come. And that's exactly what happened. Southern Russia prospered like you wouldn't believe. Well, the story also translated over to this country, in Manitoba, and in Kansas, and in Nebraska. Every place these people go, it just prospers. Mexico. And not only Mexico, but Belize. And now to Bolivia. Do you know there's 100,000 of these people in Bolivia making it prosper all over again? These people have incredible abilities. Okay, when they get into their prosperity, they have this upward social mobility. Upward social mobility and spirituality just do not go together. And there's just such a sad story that follows these people. They prosper financially and have a tragedy spiritually. The story of the Old Colony Mennonites in Mexico is an awful story, spiritually, morally. And they have actually gotten to the end of their rope, and they have asked the Old Order Amish people to come in and to help them run their schools. And the Amish people have gotten in there and are now doing an amazing... I've never seen anything like this. Whenever we Mennonites think about doing things, we think about doing things from the top down. This is not the way it's working there. They have these little committees. And they send these teachers into these schools one at a time. And they work from the bottom up. And it's... Some of these people are just responding to this. They have a whole publishing house called Central Scholar in Quellen Colony in Chihuahua. It's just mushrooming because these people are opening up to what they are teaching. That's the whole subject itself. I'm just getting distracted, so I'll just leave that. Number two, we're talking about why they declined in number and spirituality. Okay, there was a stigma of being Mennonite. They were always the tolerated people. They were so good for the country financially and business-wise, but they were despised for their religion. But when they began to be in their upward social mobility, they saw the chance of the stigma of being Mennonite to be eased. The possibility of upward social mobility was hampered by the stigma of the religion with its uniqueness of simplicity, austerity, and non-resistance. Thus, being Mennonite did not fit with the direction they were moving. So something had to give. And they wanted what they saw with upward social mobility. So they laid aside the other, their history. Number three, ungodly education. The youth were educated in a system which did not honor God. The education was deemed necessary for the progress of the next generation. And this is one of the reasons why I think you folks are sitting here. How many of you young people here that are 25 or under did not attend a Christian school? Raise your hands. One. Do you know that's one of the main reasons you're sitting here? Your leaders got this right. They understood. If you go get your education from public education, you will likely lose your faith. I never went to a Christian school. I've been a teacher in a Christian school for a number of years, but I never attended a Christian school. I had a 10th grade teacher in biology who said he's going to have me believing in evolution by the end of the year. And when I was in high school, I had to sort through world cultures, and I didn't have an apologetics. I couldn't understand why Christianity could be any better than Buddhism or Islam. Now, since I know I'm older, there are apologetics I could read, and I get some answers to my questions. But when I was a high schooler, I didn't have that. My dad gave me a book this wide, this high, called The Twilight of Evolution by Henry Morris. The creation movement was just getting started. Do you know, I come from what you call liberal Mennonites today. Lancaster Conference, I grew up there. Do you know how much loss the Mennonites have experienced in the last numbers of years? It is such a sad, sad story. Now, you can do the math on this yourself. You take one couple, husband and wife, if they have four children, and those four children each have four children, an increase by a factor of four, in 10 generations, that's a million. How many Mennonites are there in North America? Swiss, German? Nowhere close to a million. Did one couple come across? No. 4,500 of us came across. So we should be millions and millions of people by now. Maybe I can, I'm going to run out of time, but I'll just tell you. If you take those same four children and you have a loss of one and have that same kind of ratio, do you know that by the third generation, there are more unfaithful than there are faithful? I could show you all that if you want to see it, but folks, I do not want to be responsible for the loss of my children's faith. I have eight children. I've got to see that I do my level best, that my faith is transmitted to each of those. And here you are at the beginning of life. You get yourself a marriage partner that shares your faith, and you have a dedication in your heart that you're going to raise children for Christ and His kingdom. And you're going to do everything within your power to help those children walk in godliness. And you will have contributed largely to the kingdom of God. I really get sidetracked. Number four here. We're talking about reasons for decline in numbers and spirituality. Number four, men refused ordination. It didn't pay to preach. So in time when prosperity was abundantly available, men refused ordination in favor of occupation. Okay, so if some of the people are going to do that, you young men look up to certain people. You have a model in your mind. You say in your mind, I like what I see in so-and-so. I'm not sure if I like what I see in so-and-so. If the person you look up to refuses ordination, what's that going to do to you? See how that works? Number five, seminaries. Seminaries were developed to train ministers and church leaders. These institutions became theologically liberal. Thus, they did the opposite of what they're intended to do. And we're going to talk more about this problem tomorrow night. And number six, non-resistance was lost. Dutch Mennonites became involved in a political process. Their patriotism did not allow them to continue the non-resistant position. And so that by World War II, there were only three Mennonite conscientious objectors in Holland. I'm supposed to be quitting here in a few minutes. I apologize. We never got out of Holland. Maybe I can say a few things in closing here, then we'll get your questions. When these Mennonites moved east, sorry, I'm not very organized here. This is just off the map here. But when they came over here to Prussia, which is just off the map over here, they were tolerated there. And here's the rules of the toleration. They said, okay, we'll let you folks be here, but you may not make converts of anybody in your neighbors. You may not be evangelistic at all. Furthermore, if any of your people marry outside the church, the children of that marriage may not be Mennonite. And they were given land, and they had to stay on that land. They may not subdivide that land. And the pressure became intense. That's one of the reasons they went to Russia, because the land pressure. But these were tolerated people, but they were almost a squashed people. Anything that promoted growth beyond their immediate circle was forbidden. Even their worship had to happen quietly and in private homes only. Church houses were not allowed until 1600, and then with restrictions. But Mennonite prosperity aroused the envy of their less thrifty neighbors. Being of foreign origin did not help matters. And being separate from society and refusing to adopt the culture of the surrounding society increased public resentment. But in the middle of the 1600s, the political rulers discovered a good use of Mennonites. Make them taxpayers. If they make all this money, we're going to get some of it. Their prosperity could create public money. So 100 years later, they were paying an exemption tax, freeing them from military duty. And believe it or not, the money that they were providing the government was supporting a military academy. That's where it went. By 1912, the Danzig Mennonites — Danzig is the main city in this Vistula area — was almost exclusively descendants of the first Dutch settlers who had come in the 1500s. There were 369 surnames, and I'll mention just 14 of the most common. Penner was the most common. Then Weens, and then Dick, and then Klassen, and Wiebe, then Jansen, and Enns, and Jans, and Neufeld, and Friesen, and Reimer, and Epp, and Nickel, and Peters, And these names can be traced back to their Dutch origins as city dwellers, either Flemish or Friesen. And by the way, the Friesens and the Flemish maintained their distinctions from each other in Prussia. And when they went to Russia, they also kept separate from each other there as well. These people were known in their toleration. They never made any of their people a public charge. They always took care of their own poor people, their own sick people, their own elderly people. They were never allowed one of their own to become a going Social Security, I guess you could say. And wherever they have gone, they have maintained this concept to this day. These people have a three-office ministry. They have a song leader who's elected for life. They have an umbiter who goes around before communion to visit each family in the interest of spiritual unity. Evidently, they don't have a council meeting like we do. They have somebody who goes visits the families. And no church members under the age 20. They didn't join church until they were age 30 or more. There was no public funeral or even a funeral sermon before 1800 because they are tolerated people. Someone would write a poem with many verses and set it to a well-known melody, and that was the funeral. Okay, the last thing I want to say, and I'll shut up. Over here in Prussia, they changed languages. They brought Holland Dutch with them, but they lived and worked among the people in the Vistula area, and they spoke Low German. And it's called Plattdeutsch. Does your mom know Plattdeutsch? Do you know Plattdeutsch? If you know High German or Pennsylvania Dutch, you can almost not communicate between Plattdeutsch and Pennsylvania Dutch. They're both German. One's Low German, one's High German, but they're very different. And folks, this Plattdeutsch, they carry everywhere they go. It's almost become part of their faith. They took it to Russia. They took it to Canada. They took it to Mexico. My guess is they're taking it to Bolivia. Plattdeutsch is sacred, almost sacred to them. All right. What questions do you have?